Okay, good morning, and welcome to week 2 of 2, the Book of Jonah, More Than a Fish Story. I'll ask people to please silence their phones. It's like a flight attendant. I've got a prop. It's like when they demonstrate how to do a seatbelt, because apparently in 2019 there are still people who need instructions on that. If you're not yet on the email list for the class, please make sure that you give me your email address. You will get the follow-up email for this, and you will also get the flyer hot off the presses for the next session. The next series is starting, God willing, November 6th, after the holidays. It will run for 6 weeks. And our topic is life after death. Where does the soul come from? Where does it go? Heaven, hell, limbo, reincarnation, all sorts of fun stuff. So that will be a 6-week course. As with this, it's $60 for the series, or people can choose to pay 10 per session. I'm going to send it out. I'll send out the flyer after class today, and registration online is already available. It's odd to be thinking about November, isn't it? But that's the way it goes, because October doesn't exist. That's not odd. That happens all the time. Also, I will note, because some people have asked, I do have a general email list for the classes that I teach and the others in my Beit Midrash program teach around the city. And if anyone wants to sign up for that email list, it's a free email. It comes out Thursday mornings. I'd be glad to add you. I'll probably include that in the follow-up email from today's class as well, so people can just email me to let me know. Last week, we reviewed the story of Jonah, talked a little bit about how it's structured in a way that enables easy retelling to a crowd. It's clearly meant as a teaching tool. We learned why Jonah ran away. We talked about him running away to save the Jews. We talked about him running away because he's angry about divine mercy, which is going to be a major part of the message this morning. We didn't actually mention, but there is another school of thought that suggests he ran away because, as he says in chapter 4, he knows that God is going to forgive the people of Nineveh, and he doesn't want to look like a liar. Yeah, here I am announcing to everybody, I got a big sandwich board, the end of the world is nigh, and nothing happens after 40 days. Granted that, the rabbinic commentators on it say, well, it sort of does happen, because it says in 40 days the city will be overturned, and the city was overturned. They changed their ways. Nonetheless, that's another school of thought on why Jonah doesn't want to carry the message. In any case, we talked about why he ran away, and more fundamentally, why he returns to God. What is it that brings him back? And we talked about his response to his suffering first in his anger at God, and then his suffering in terms of being in the water and then being in the fish, and how he remembers how good it was to have that relationship with God, and that's what draws him back, as he expresses in chapter 2. Well, this week, what I want to do is the following. First of all, I want to learn about how Jonah and God debate the forgiveness of Nineveh in chapter 4, and to ask the question of why human beings matter to God, as is seen in God's response to Jonah in chapter 4. And again, as with last week, it will hopefully provide us with some ideas and some inspiration as we head into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So if you have a sheet, and for anyone who doesn't have one, the extras are over there on the table. So if you take a look at source number 1, this is a translation of the bulk of chapter 3 in Jonah. Skip to the opening 2 sentences. The opening 2 sentences are actually a lot of fun. They're just not to the point for this class. The opening 2 sentences are, God says to Jonah a second time, get up and go to Nineveh, the big city, and give them the message that I am giving you. In other words, okay, we're back at square one, Jonah. Here you go. Here's your job. Let's see if you've learned anything. And he does, because that's where source number 1 picks up. Jonah went at once to Nineveh in accordance with God's command. Yay! Nineveh was an enormously large city, a 3 days' walk across. It's very interesting on this point. I don't think I brought it for you on the sheet. No, I didn't bring it for you on the sheet. It's a little superfluous, but it's still fun. The commentators debate the size of the city and how you view the 3 days, and it gets into this whole circumference equals 2 pi r, you know, discussion. It does. So that Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra says the city is 3 days in circumference, and therefore walking through it takes 1 day. So it says that it's a 3 days walk across. Jonah started out and made his way into the city. The distance of 1 day's walk means that it's actually 3 days to go around the city, and therefore 1 day's walk takes him entirely through the city. And that's one view. Rabbi David Kimchi Radak, on the other hand, says no, 3 days is the diameter of the city, and he walks 1 day into it, so now he is in the heart of the city, right in the downtown, where you don't want to be a prophet walking around, if I had to guess. But that's the debate between the two of them about what these dimensions of the city are. In any case, he walks into the city, and he proclaims, 40 days more, and Nineveh shall be overthrown. Od arba'im yom, v'Nineveh nehepachet. 40 days, Nineveh will be overthrown. The number 40 is a fun number in Tanakh. Right? What 40s do we know? 40 days and 40 nights for the flood, right? The flood, it rains. It rains for 40 days and 40 nights, sorry.
10 times you came up, okay?
Well, because there's four letters. Okay. 40 years in the wilderness. Moshe is up on the mountain for 40 days. Good. 40 days is always a very interesting number. Sorry?
I say a few times.
A few times, right. He's up and down, up and down, up and down. This is true. The Meraglim, the spies who go into the land, spend 40 days within the land of Israel, which is what leads to 40 years of remaining in the wilderness. 40 is often a number biblically that's associated with sin and punishment. 40 days in general is not a good thing. The rain during the flood obviously fits that. 40 years in the wilderness for the generation to die out also fits that. Even 40 days of Moses being up on the mountain, it's about getting forgiveness for the Jews. It's all associated with sin and punishment and potentially forgiveness. And there are other examples of that as you get beyond the Chumash and further into Tanakh as well. But just think of the 40. The 40 is interesting. So the people of Nineveh believed God. They proclaimed a fast. Great and small alike put on sackcloth. So the people believe. When the news reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his robe, put on sackcloth, and sat in ashes. And he had the word cried through Nineveh, by decree of the king and his nobles. No man, oh, this is a good room for this. By decree of the king and his nobles, no man or beast, a flock or herd, shall taste anything. They shall not graze, they shall not drink water. They shall be covered with sackcloth, man and beast, and shall cry mightily to God. Let everyone turn back from his evil ways and from the injustice of which he is guilty. Who knows but that God may turn and relent? He may turn back from his wrath so that we do not perish. Well, that's interesting to me. What's odd here in that passage we just read?
They don't worship God, so why is it?
Yeah, why did they respond like that? These are people who have been bad enough, right, that there's a message coming that in 40 days you're going to be overturned. These aren't people who, they're sort of good, sort of bad, on the fence, I don't know. These are people who are on the doomsday clock at 11:59, right? Suddenly, God said we should change our ways? You bet, sackcloth and ashes all around. Like, why did they listen? That's one question. What else? Yes, Ethi.
Little Jonah comes to the town and says, God is going to destroy me. Everybody all of a sudden is in for it.
Well, he's not little. Keep in mind, he is an experienced prophet with a track record of success. He was the one who said that the Jews were going to win their war and expand their territory, and it came true. So I wouldn't minimize his significance in this.
Would it be fear that they decided that they better do it, otherwise they will be destroyed?
I mean, fear is certainly a piece of this, but why believe him?
Also, the people did it before the king himself, and then the king proclaims it.
Right. The people seem to respond on their own before you even get a king. Stephen, you were going to say?
What evil have the animals done?
That was really the question I expected people to ask. What are you doing with the animals? What did my animal did wrong? What is this? Man and beast, right? Shall be covered in sackcloth. Man and beast. No one is going to eat. Well, I don't know how long they're fasting. To be fair, I don't think they're fasting the full 40 days because then they're out of the beast business. You know what it's slightly reminiscent of? It's reminiscent of Lot. Right? It's reminiscent of Lot, the brother of Sarah, brother-in-law, therefore, of Abraham. If you remember the story in the city of Sodom, where the visitors come to the city, and he insists, you have to come into my house, you're not safe out here in the street, and he pushes them until they finally go into the house, fine, and then the mob attacks the house, and they say, take out these men, and we wish to molest them. And what is Lot's response? He says, don't do that. Here, my daughters instead. Like, no, dude. What are you thinking? You were really good when you were being the hero and you were protecting them. Why did you offer your daughters? But the answer with Lot seems to be that he doesn't grasp what he's actually doing. Meaning, he understands. He has absorbed the lesson of taking care of others and protecting the vulnerable. Hospitality, certainly. But something didn't take quite right. That's what this is like here. We're going to repent. We're going to fast. We're going to wear sackcloth. And the animals too. Like, no, that's not part of what we do. It's very strange. What is this business with the animals? And why do they listen? So these are important questions. Rabbinic commentators offer some suggestions for why they listened. To try to explain why they would do it. There's one suggestion. When you look back at the story of the Yamsuf, the Red Sea, when the Egyptians drown in the sea, the Torah actually says that no one remained of those Egyptians who had raced after the Jews, except, it sounds like it says, Ad Echad, which means either to the man, they're all gone, or there's one left. And if there's going to be one left from all of those Egyptians who have pursued the Jews, who's that going to be? Pharaoh. Right, he is the one among the Egyptians. And so there's an idea that's suggested in the Midrash that actually Pharaoh is the king here. And that's why this time around, when a message comes and says, I'm going to overturn the city, he says, I think it's time to listen now. It's a very interesting idea. It links stories and links certain texts in a very interesting way. But it's hard to take that literally, if only because they listened before the king ever heard the message. So it's not about the Pharaoh's influence. Also, Egypt, Assyria, very different places, very different eras and so forth. Yes, understood.
But the reason that the Pharaoh was not the, with everybody is that they should see what God did.
Yeah, no, and there's a lot to be said for it. It's just, it's hard to place him on the scene of this story. The Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, offers another suggestion. In the first chapter, that whole story with the boat, we didn't discuss the boat story at length because we did that the last time we talked about Jonah. But the sailors, afterwards, come up on land and they bring sacrifices and they tell everybody about how this happened, that there was a big storm and that they threw him overboard and then the storm stopped and God saved them. And so the suggestion of Rabbi Kimchi is maybe the sailors made it to Nineveh. And that they told them about their experience. The problem with that is that, again, that's the wrong way. That storm happened off the coast of Israel, right? Nineveh, Assyria, is way off. It's entirely landlocked. Absolutely. The Mediterranean was off to the west. That was the point. He was trying to get away from going to Assyria, which is way to the east. It's not landlocked in the sense of being no water. They're on a river. Nineveh is on a river. But it's the wrong direction. So that's hard also to sustain. So you tell me then, why did they listen? Why do the people of Nineveh listen? I would suggest that it seems like they are listening because this is the first time anyone has told them this. Meaning, these aren't the Jews. The Jews have a very long history of prophets coming to them and saying, you're doing things wrong, go back to God. Right? That happens throughout the book of Judges. That happens throughout the book, off and on, in the book of Shmuel, Samuel. It happens throughout the book of Kings. We are used to prophets coming to us and saying, you're doing something wrong, it's time to change. Nineveh, on the other hand, is being entirely consistent with Assyrian behavior. This is what Assyrians do, and we'll find out what they were doing. We have to talk about what their sins were. But this is actually the first time that they're hearing this message. The first time someone says to you, it's time to shape up, maybe it has a little bit of a different resonance. And so that could be. They're not yet deaf to this message that Jonah is bringing. But the king formalizes it and says, I am issuing this decree. He gets off the throne. He puts himself in sackcloth on the ground. And the people and the animals. So what's with the animals? So take a look, please, at source number two. Talmud offers a suggestion. What did they do with these animals? They bound the animals in one area and the young in another area and declared, Master of the universe, if you do not have mercy on us, we will not have mercy on these. They separate the animals and their young. There's precedent for this. There's a story in the beginning of the book of Samuel in which the Philistines, it's a long story, but the Philistines essentially are making a test. They had captured the Aron, the Ark, and they start to suffer a plague, and they want to send the Ark back to the Jews. And they want to test, is this really from God, everything that's happening? And so what they do is, they put the ark in a new wagon, being led by a cow, being pulled by a cow that has never pulled anything before. And they take the young, and they lock up the young in a stall, so the young are mooing, or whatever, lowing. And the mother hears, and they say, let's see what happens if the mother takes the ark back on the wagon to the Jews, despite the fact that it has never pulled a wagon before, there is no rider directing it, and it's hearing the young behind, then we'll know this must be a miracle from God. So that's sort of a precedent for this idea of recognizing the power of the young on the parent animal. Of course, we have mitzvot in the Torah, right? We have commandments in the Torah about that, sending away the mother bird if you're going to take the young, not slaughtering the mother and the young on the same day. We have this idea elsewhere. But the way that the Talmud sees it is, they appeal to God saying, if you won't have mercy on us, we won't have mercy on them. Again, though, it's this very corrupt way of doing things. Right? In order to get God to be merciful on us, we are going to cause the animals to suffer. God, if you don't want the animals to suffer, you better do something for us. It's this very corrupt way for them to go about this. There's a better approach, number three, a more benign approach. They declared, Master of the universe, beasts know nothing, and you find merit for them. View us too as beasts. All of us are the same. That's a nicer message than, I'm going to torture the animals until you forgive us. But it's still, fundamentally, but you are torturing the animals. And I think that's part of the point here, which is that the people of Nineveh are being portrayed for the reader as people who are unschooled religiously. People who, left to their own devices, are going to come up with this kind of a method of approaching God because they don't have any better way to do it. And that's going to come back in chapter 4 as well. But I think that's a key element for us to understand, is that the people of Nineveh are being portrayed as people who are new to all of this. So they cry out to God, they sit in the ashes, they make their animals suffer as well, they're fasting, and then the end of the chapter, still number one, the last couple of lines. God saw what they did, how they were turning back from their evil ways, and God renounced the punishment he had planned to bring upon them and did not carry it out. God says, okay, I'm not overturning the city. Yes, Susan.
This is way past so many things things that have happened over the years about God and about the Jewish God.
Okay.
And then to suddenly say they were unschooled, they had no idea of his power or whatever, is kind of like hard to...
I don't think it's that they're unschooled in terms of knowing stories about the Jewish God. I think it's unschooled in terms of knowing what that God expects of people. That God expects of people certain behaviors and not others. You know, in the same way that in pagan society, for a long time, you have human sacrifice. This is an attempt to appeal to God that in Judaism, we are told from the get-go, is off-limits. But that's the idea, is that this is that kind of a society. It's not that they don't know stories about God, they may even know about Jonah and his reputation. But it's that, in terms of what the Torah teaches us is the way to God's heart, so to speak, they're unschooled. That's what I was trying to suggest. Jonathan, you were going to say?
Wouldn't the people of Nineveh pray to idols? When you pray to an idol, you sacrifice stuff. The idol comes and eats it, and our God doesn't eat the food. So it would be natural for them to bribe, to bargain with God, because that's what they've been doing with their idol.
Right, you don't see any offerings, you don't see any bribe mentioned here, but the bargaining, certainly so, is consistent with what you would have seen in society as a whole. I would agree with that. Nurit?
Just in the same thing, did they know about the Jewish sacrifice?
So it's a good question. What would they have known about Jewish sacrifice? Right.
Then this whole argument is not valid because you do your sacrifice, you let them proceed, these sacrifices helping the enemies.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, right? If they're familiar with our animal sacrifice, then what they're doing, I mean, I would argue that slaughtering the animal as opposed to having it fast, you know, however many fasts they did, or separating the mother and the young, I think they are fundamentally different. Slaughtering in a carnivorous society is, you know, just what happens on a daily basis. But in terms of what they would have known of Jewish sacrifice, it's actually an interesting question. Jonah is a prophet from the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom of Israel, as opposed to the southern kingdom, isn't going to the temple in Jerusalem. And they have quite a bit of paganism that's going on within their land itself. So it's a good question. What would Nineveh have known? I'm not sure. Judith, and then I'm going to go a little further with this. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it possible that there is other symbolism here in terms of turning from evil ways to, you know, remedy that and showing this Jordan it's like a
good. Right. So Judith asks whether there isn't an image here that's part of the lesson for the reader. And I think there is. Rabbi Leo Kramer, better known as the Vilna Gaon, one of the leading sages in Judaism of the last 500, if not 1,000 years, lived at the end of the 18th century in Lithuania, wrote a mystical commentary to the book of Jonah, in which he points out that the Yonah in Tanakh can be an image of the soul. And he goes through the book, reading it as being about death and reincarnation and so forth. He goes down into the water and he comes up out of the water. And you could definitely, I don't remember if he does this, but you could definitely link that to the idea that they're casting off their animal selves, so to speak, by having the animal fast, and it's a reference to the material. You could totally read it that way. He's not saying don't read the story literally, but he's saying here's another dimension that the reader is supposed to get out of it. And that will be consistent, I think, with what you're suggesting. So I wanted to call your attention here, though, to the line about what God saw. The Talmud picks up on this line. God saw what they did, how they were turning back from their evil ways. So take a look at source number 4, please. This passage out of the Talmud is part of the liturgy on days when the community fasts for rain, when there's a drought, and there's a fast for rain. So this is what the leader is supposed to say. Our brothers, sackcloth and fasting do not cause divine favor. Only repentance and good deeds cause it. For so we found regarding the people of Nineveh that it does not say God saw their sackcloth and fasting. Rather it says, and God saw their deeds, that they had returned from their evil ways. The translation is slightly different because in number 4 it's my translation, and number 1 it was taken from the JPS. But it's the same words in the Hebrew. The idea is not you wore sackcloth, you fasted, therefore I'm going to forgive you. But rather they repented of their wrongdoing. What was their wrongdoing?
So,
yes.
What were their evil ways?
What were their evil ways in the first place?
How does that affect Israel ultimately?
Right. So the their evil ways, we are taught, were abuse of the vulnerable, ways that the Jews also are accused of behaving. Abuse of the vulnerable, corruption, and violence. Think of like the city of Sodom as a model for it. Sorry. If you take a look at source number 5, I want to introduce a very interesting book. The book is called Nahum. No one knows anything about this book. And what I mean by that is not no one knows. There is stuff to be known. But people aren't familiar with it, largely because it's never read in the synagogue. There's no Haftorah that comes from the book of Nahum. It doesn't have an exciting story to tell. It's part of what's called Treyasar, the collection of 12 small books of prophecy that appears at the end of the section of prophets within Tanakh. But what Nahum actually is Jonah part 2. That's what it is. It's Jonah part 2. Nahum is a prophet, Nahum HaElkoshi, who comes to give a message to the Assyrian Empire. The same Assyrian Empire we're talking about here. But he's after Jonah. And what he says to them is, time's up. You may have escaped the first time, but you're not escaping this time. You have gone back to your evil ways, and therefore God is going to destroy the Assyrian Empire. That's after the Assyrians have already destroyed Israel, our northern kingdom, and exiled the 10 tribes.
So it's after they destroyed Israel.
Correct. So take a look at source number 5, the verse from the beginning of the 3rd chapter of Nahum, where he talks to Nineveh, and he calls it city of crime, utterly treacherous, full of violence, where killing never stops. That's how he views them, and that's the litany of their sins. It goes on in chapter 3 of Nahum.
Is it mentioned that it's about Nineveh?
Yes. I believe it actually begins, Masa Nineveh. That's actually, if I remember, I have a Tanakh here, so I'll open it up and see. Yes, it begins, Masa Nineveh, Sefer Chazon Nahum HaElkoshi. So yes, he is speaking to the city of Nineveh, and he goes on about the evil. It's 3 chapters of a lot of fun. So the point here is, though, that that's what the Talmud believes they have reversed here. So they talk about the following thing. There's a question that's brought up in Jewish law. Let's say the following thing happens. Someone's building a house. He needs a beam. He sees, passing a construction site, that there's a beam there. And he says, I could use that. And he goes in the middle of the night, takes the beam, builds it into his home, and is living there. Sometime later, it's found out. The victim, the person whose beam had been stolen, comes to him and says, you stole my beam. I want it back. Do you make him dismantle the house in order to restore the lost beam? Or do you just say, let him replace it? What would you say? You're all such nice people. Just let them replace it. So the law is that theoretically you could say to him, I want that beam back. However, in order to enable him to repent, because otherwise he's just not going to do it, we say accept the payment instead. Don't demand that he actually return the beam. However, the Talmud here says that that's what they did. People in Nineveh who had stolen things and incorporated into their property went to the step of restoring it. That doesn't necessarily mean that literally they went the step of doing like this story actually happened. The Talmud is trying to give you an example of them going above and beyond to make things right. They said, we're going to straighten things out. That's what God sees. Interestingly, Go back to, again, source number one, the last sentence. And God renounced the punishment he had planned to bring upon them. If you were to look in the Hebrew, you would see Vayinachem ha'elokim al hara'a asher diber la'asot lahem v'lo'asa. Vayinachem is more than just he renounced. Hebrew speakers, what does Vayinachem suggest?
Comfort.
Oh, there's comfort.
Pity.
He had pity on them? Okay. But it also suggests a retraction. In other words, to be mitnachem is to say, I was going to do this, and now I am not going to do it. Which raises philosophical questions. Can God change his mind? So Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra says, don't get worked up about it. In source number 6, he says, the Torah spoke in human vernacular. It doesn't mean literally that God has changed his mind. God always knew what was going to happen. The irony to me, though, is the name of the prophet who comes back and says, actually, I am going to destroy it, is Nahum. Same root as Vayinachem. So apparently you could change your mind again. That to me is the lesson. Well, it depends on how you look at it and how you frame changing one's mind. I'm partial to Ibn Ezra's approach, which is it's his behavior changes, and in that sense, it indicates a change of mind. Yeah. Okay, so in chapter 3, we read that the people of Nineveh listened to Jonah, perhaps because this is a new thing for them. They haven't had prophets browbeating them before. They make an attempt at repentance in this very unusual way, or unusual to us, causing the animals to suffer as well.
But it's very interesting that what Jonah said in the whole book are five words, all the way in the opening, but he did not tell them how it was.
Right, so we generally assume that he had to have said more than five words, and we're just not being given the full speech. There has to be more than just Jonah walking through the city and repeating over and over again, you know, in another 40 days Nineveh is going to be destroyed or overturned. Now, there has to be more to the conversation, or else the story just doesn't make sense. I just don't know what it was.
But not in the book itself, because everything else is from the Midrash. All what we are explaining is not from the Pshat, it's not from what's written.
I would disagree with. I agree with you that in order to make sense of the story, you have to read in things. However, you have to remember, each Midrash that we've quoted, except possibly the Paro one, which has sources outside of Jonah, has sources within the text itself. So for example, this is a really important point. This is not a minor point of methodology when you study Tanakh. There's a tendency that people have to say, there's the literal read of the sentences, and then there's the Midrash, which is not what the sentences say. But the truth of the matter is that for the vast majority of Midrash, it's anchored in the text itself. For example, the Midrash that says that God responds not to their sackcloth and ashes, but rather to their reversal of wrongdoing, is linked to the fact that the verse itself said, God saw what they did, how they were turning back from their evil ways. Not about the fasting, but that they actually retracted. That's what it's based on. Midrash, generally speaking, is bothered by something within the text, and it has a finer ear than the literalist who just says, give me a story and I'm going to move on. There's more to be said, but we have a lot to cover here, and we're in the second half already. So, that brings us to chapter 4, which is the showdown between Jonah and God. Take a look at source number 7. We found out in the close of chapter 3 that God has forgiven Nineveh. And this was very bad to Jonah, and it angered him. And he prayed to God, and he said, please, God, has this not been my word since I was on my land? This is why I fled to Tarshish first, for I knew you're gracious and merciful, patient and generous, and you repent of causing harm. Jonah is angry. Interestingly, it's unclear to me and to the commentators whether this is during the 40 days and God had already told him the people are going to be forgiven, or whether it's after the 40 days. Ibn Ezra and Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, take the view that this is actually within the 40 days that this event is taking place, so it's not technically done yet. We asked last time, why, if Jonah changed his mind in chapter 2 and came close to God, why is he still angry here? But our answer was, he only changed his mind on his relationship with God. He didn't change his mind about forgiveness. He still doesn't think you should have the chance to repent and do tshuva. So he prays to God, as it is worded here. They call it a prayer. And his prayer is, ha, you're so merciful, that's terrible. So what does he do? Take a look at the flip side of the page. Source number 10. We're going to come back to sources 8 and 9. I'm not done yet on those. In the beginning of source number 10, God says to him, are you very upset? Are you very upset, Jonah? And Jonah left the city. Because what do you say back to that? And he settled east of the city. And he made a hut for himself. And he sat beneath it in the shade to see what would occur in the city. Jonah makes a sukkah, actually, in the original Hebrew. He makes a shelter for himself. And he says, I want to see what's going to happen. Meaning, I want to see whether they are actually going to stick with their repentance. But Jonah is a very unhappy man at this point. So much so, go back to source number 8, where Rabbi David Kimchi says that the prayer part was not him saying that, it's not Jonah saying that he... Sorry. The prayer part of this is not Jonah saying, I know you're merciful and that's terrible. Rather, it is Jonah prayed, please take my life. And he began with, please, God. The prayer was his desire to die. And you know what I see that I did? Huh. That's bad. I omitted a sentence. And now I understand why I was having trouble with it. Okay. Sentence three is not here, and it should be. So at the end of source number 7, I'm going to add this, and God willing, when I send out the follow-up email, I will have a version of the sheet for you that has the sentence, because it's really important. After Jonah says, and you repent of causing harm, he says, and now God, take my life from me, I would be better dead than alive. That's Jonah's sentence, which, yeah, should have been on the source sheet, I think. And that's what Radak, Rabbi Kimchi, number 8, says is the prayer. The prayer is that he wants to die. And that's where God says back to him, huh, are you very upset, Jonah? Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, number 9, says this is actually a pattern among Jewish prophets who are frustrated and angry about what God has asked them to do. He says, I don't want to be there anymore. Like Moses saying, erase me from your book. Or like what Jonah did on the boat. Jonah's message to God on a simple, straightforward level is, mercy is inappropriate, they should be dead, and I am upset that you have chosen to allow Nineveh to live. So God says, Jonah, I'm going to send you a wake-up call. And arguably, this is the third wake-up call in the book. The first wake-up call were the sailors on the boat who told him to pray to God. The second wake-up call is the fish, right? The fish itself is a wake-up call. And here you get a third wake-up call. Back in source number 10 now.
Isn't Nineveh a wake-up call?
You mean the fact that God is willing to forgive them?
And that they did.
And that they actually repented. Okay, that's fair. You could see them as a wake-up call also. That's fair. And God appointed a kikayon. What is a kikayon? I love this part of the book. Take a look at source number 11. Rabbi David Kimchi says, I'll tell you what a kikayon is. This is a grass which grows in long blades, which grow tall and create shade. We find...
Large leaves.
We find in the Mishnah, it's talking about what types of oil you're allowed to use for candles Friday night, for the, you know, when they use an oil lamp. And it says, don't use oil of kik. And they explain, what is kik? And Reish Lakish said, the kikayon of Jonah. That kind of plant. Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, one of the sages, said, I saw the kikayon of Jonah. It looked like a sloliva. It grew among ponds of water. They suspended over the entrances of stores for shade. They make oil from its seeds. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Chofni explained it is a grass which is called in Arabic al-baroa. I have found it in the responsa of the Gaonim. Sloliva is a tree which does not bear fruit. We have many of them here. They produce seeds from which we make oil. Anyone who has a lot of colds drinks this oil. In Arabic it is called al-kiroa. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, on the other hand, in source number 12, the Sephardic sages say it is a gourd or pumpkin. There's no need to know what it is. It's a kikayon! Get over it! Fine. I just like the two different approaches there. One who's going to tell you everything about kikayon you could possibly unpack, and the other one who just says, don't worry about it, it's a plant. Move. What? Essentially, yes. So let's go back now into number 10. What happens with the kikayon? God appointed a kikayon, and it grew over Jonah as shade over his head, saving him from harm. And Jonah was very happy. For the first time in the book, right? Jonah's happy. He's got his shelter. He's got his kikayon. And God appointed a worm at the next dawn, and it struck the kikayon, which dried up. It ate through the roots, and the kikayon died. And when the sun shone, God appointed a mighty east wind, and the sun struck Jonah, and he became weak. He asked to die, saying, it will be better for me to die than to live. And God said to Jonah, are you very upset over the kikayon? And he said, I am very upset to death. So dramatic, Jonah. This is a fascinating thing. The whole thing here is fascinating. The repetition of, are you very upset, right, echoes what happened in the beginning of the book, right? In the beginning of the book, God said, get up, go to Nineveh. And then, after the incident in the fish, he said to him again, get up and go to Nineveh, right? Because he was supposed to learn something in between. And now, he says to him, are you very upset? And Jonah's supposed to learn from the kikayon. And he comes back to him and says, oh, are you very upset? Like, what did you learn from this story? Are you very upset is one way to look at what God is, in fact, asking him.
What are the words in Hebrew?
Ha'etev chara lach. Another way to look at it is to say, ha'etev chara lach, are you right for being so upset? Meaning, Jonah, do you think your anger is justified? And Jonah apparently does think that he is justified. What has Jonah done here in this story? What did Jonah do, first of all, in the beginning of this passage? He left the city, and he settled himself outside of the city. Jonah holds himself apart. On the boat, he didn't want anything to do with anybody. He goes to the bottom of the boat. He's going to go to sleep on his own. He wants nothing to do with the people of Nineveh. God, you wanted me to give them a message. I walked through the city. I gave him a message. Now I'm leaving the city. Jonah says, I am not like them. The people of the city said, who knows, maybe God will forgive. Jonah says, I know you forgive. Not happy about it, but I know your ways. I am not like them. I think there's another layer. Biblically, who lives outside the city? Well, there is no city. He's in the middle of a desert. He leaves his home, that's true. But who? What type of person is supposed to live outside the city, yeah? Ela shemuchramim, ela b'chumash. Lo muchramim, ela?
Lepers.
You got it. Don't point him when you say lepers. That's not nice. He said lepers. It wasn't. Okay. The mitzora. The person who is a mitzora has to live outside of the city. Classically, how do we understand the sin of the mitzora as it appears in the Torah multiple times? Lashon hara, a person who speaks badly, not as a gossip, but a person who speaks harmfully about others, as in Jonah, who spoke harmfully about the city of Nineveh, and frankly, even about God. He is an outcast. He is forced out of the city.
But he's self-exiled. Nobody forced him.
Oh, yeah, no, that's absolutely true. You could do more with this. There's Moshe and the tent of meeting that moves outside of the camp. There's, well, Miriam was an example of Lashon Hara leading to being outside. That's correct. That's one of the examples. There are other examples of people being sent out. Of course, Adam and Eve go to live outside the Garden of Eden. There's more you could do with this, but I don't think you should ignore that image of Jonah moving out of the city. Jonathan.
I have a problem with this because Jonah's a prophet. He's been a prophet for the northern states.
Yep.
For umpteen years. And as a prophet, he might know that if God forgives Nineveh, then they will destroy the northern cities.
Correct.
So it could be that he just wasn't mad because God is forgiven. He's mad because he's going to see his people destroyed.
Right, and that's Abarbanel's view. Abarbanel believes that Jonah's angry because his actions are going to lead to the destruction of the northern kingdom. The weakness of that is, number one, he didn't say that explicitly in the book. He only says, I'm angry at forgiveness, which sounds like the forgiveness is what upsets him. The other weakness of that is that that God has many ways to save Nineveh. If it's not going to be Jonah, it's going to be somebody else. Him drowning isn't going to help. I'm going to move a little further with this because there's a lot still to say and some key things for us to learn. Notice that the book has gone full circle. The first lesson for Jonah came about via God appointing a wind, right, on the water to attack the boat. And here, this last lesson comes about again through this deafening, powerful wind. It's interesting to note. But God speaks to Jonah after saying, are you very upset? Take a look at source number 13. And God said to Jonah, are you very upset over the Kikayon? Right, this is just overlap with source number 10. Are you very upset about the Kikayon? And he said, I am very upset to death. And God said to him, you would have mercy for the Kikayon, for which you did not work and which you did not cultivate, which came in a night and was lost in a night. Shall I not have mercy upon Nineveh, the great city, which includes more than 120,000 people who do not know right from left, and many beasts? That's God's answer, and that's the end of the book. Afterwards, it does not say, and Jonah said, I'm sorry. That's not there. But what is God saying? What is the lesson that he's trying to teach Jonah? You don't know my ways? I think he gives him more than that to work with.
You don't know my mercy, you don't know my...
No, but there's more to it. There's a contrast being drawn here. Yeah, Nuri.
He said, for things that you didn't welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, so what does it mean? You're right. What does that mean?
That's why it coincides with what the people did.
Yeah.
So it's about doing.
Yeah.
So Jonah is a prophet. To see results, you can't just say I'm going or not and choose his victims or for lack of other wills. So Jonah has to will, the people of Nineveh has to will in order to achieve what God is inspired them to do.
So they worked. It's interesting. It's a great point. The only problem is that that's not what God said to him. He didn't talk about them working.
Like we said about you didn't will for the Kikayon, it came in good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else. Right, and I think it's a valid contrast. It's just, I'm looking for something that fits. He's trying to say, I do things one way, you do things another way. But I don't see why. I see their hands here first, Lyle. I'm sorry. I saw a few people who were waiting from before. Paul was first, Susan, Sandy, Marlene, and then we'll get over to this way. Yeah, Paul. It's a nice message, but how do you see him saying that here? He said, mercy trumps justice, but how do you see that here? Where do you see that? It's a nice message. I like the idea. I'll vote for that. But I still don't see. Susan, what were you going to say?
I see that he's saying, look, you have sympathy for a board or whatever it is, but that's just applying to really people and human beings who've been around for so long. You don't have any feeling for them. How can you have feeling for this inanimate or... that's not much, and yet these people who have built a great city and they have sinned, but they didn't know right from left, they didn't know what they were doing. You know, forgive them, Lord, they do not know what they do. It's sort of.
I don't think that's ours.
No, I don't.
But Right. So what, that's one, right? That's one way to look at it, is you're merciful on the plant. How could you not be merciful on the city? I want to come back to that, but I just want to take the suggestions first. Sandy.
Okay. God gives him this plant or whatever, bird or whatever you want to call it, has an offering, has a shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonah, he didn't work for it, he just got it.
Yep.
And he's, not only does he not appreciate it, he's actually disdainful for it.
Yeah.
How can you not, so God saying, how can you, you have no appreciation for this, and you have no understanding or appreciation for these people that don't.
Right, and that's along the lines of where Susan was going with it. It's the comparison of you're merciful for the plant, I'm merciful for the city. Marlene.
I think it, to me, this God asserting his role as a creator.
Yeah.
I created the people, and I created the beast, and I have the capacity to show mercy.
Mm-hmm. By dint of my work.
Yes.
Because I worked for it, I get to say, Jonah, you don't get a vote on this one. Good. There were a couple of hands here. Lionel and...
Okay. Similarly, it's I created the good as a bad. I created the Ninevites. I created Israel. And if I choose to say that they have repented and give them a chance again, it's my call, not your call.
Okay, so again, part of that, I'm the creator. I'm the one who worked on and created. Jack.
I know. To me, it's very simple. Jonah wanted them to be destroyed. He didn't care about the people. Maybe what God is teaching him here is that there's more value in saving humanity.
Mm-hmm. So it's about the value of them. Okay. I'm going to take Stephen, and then I'm going to shut down questions because I've got 9 minutes. Yeah.
The demise of the gourd had nothing was external.
Mm-hmm.
From external circumstances, nothing to do with the gourd. Good or bad.
Yeah.
But the demise, but the people caused themselves to deteriorate to such a situation.
Yeah.
And they're responsible for getting themselves out of it by their actions.
So you're giving Jonah's response. Jonah could say back, there was no reason to destroy the gourd. There was reason to destroy the people. Is that what you're suggesting?
No. The gourd was destroyed from nothing it itself had done.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that makes the gourd less deserving of destruction than the city. I think you're doing a job of arguing for Jonah. I want to point out a few things. The core ideas that have been suggested here a few times are either you are merciful on a plant, I'm merciful on human beings and animals, or you didn't work for this plant, I created this city. There are two weaknesses with these approaches. Number one, if your argument is going to be, you didn't work, but I worked, there's no such thing as work when you're God. There's no such thing as work. It didn't cost God anything to do it. There's no effort. Yeah, that's true. Whatever that means. There's no such thing as work. Even Ezra notes that. That's number one. Number two, Jonah was not merciful on the plant. Jonah's merciful on himself. He doesn't care about the plant. He cares that he has shade. It wasn't like he was crying, oh, the poor plant. He's crying, oh, poor Jonah. There's no mercy for the plant here. So I think what it's talking about here, and some of you came close to this in different ways, is it's about what a human being values and what God values. It's not about mercy. And it's not about investment. It's about value. Jonah, your criteria for what you value is self-interest. Is it going to help? Self-interest. Is it going to help you? That's your criterion. He demonstrates a narrowness of perception and personality focused on what's good for me. And I hate to say this about someone who was a prophet of God, because that's not something that's supposed to be a flaw in a prophet. If the book didn't present it, I wouldn't feel comfortable saying it. But he's upset to death over big metaphysical issues, repentance, forgiveness, and he's upset to death about a hot summer day. Did you notice that? He uses the same words to express his anger over forgiveness and to express his anger over the loss of his shade. Jonah, get a grip. Perspective here. You're determining value based on your scale and based on what you see and what you personally like or don't like. God says, on the other hand, what I value is life. I value the universe I have created. And that may be a gourd, and that may be an animal, and that may be a city. But that's where I place the focus. Take a look, please, at source number 14. Rabbi David Kimchi. That which a person works on, he is more upset when it is destroyed. Even though God did not work on creating his creations, the Torah used human expressions that listeners would understand. I mean, there's no work, but we call it work, because what else are you going to call it? God created them. Even though he wished to spare the Kikayon only due to his own pain, talking about Jonah, so God wished to spare Nineveh for his honor. For all that is created is his honor. As it says, Melokh al haaretz kvodo, the entire universe is God's honor. And certainly human beings. God says, I value this city. To me, the city has value. You have petty concerns, I have major concerns. And I tried repeatedly, Jonah, to teach you about what to value. I tried with the sailors, I tried with you in the water, I tried with the city of Nineveh, but it didn't work. It didn't take. And so the lesson that we are meant to draw from here, as I see it, is that God forgives because God values life. And it doesn't matter that this life is ignorant and error-prone, right? It doesn't matter that the people of Nineveh are unschooled in what we believe and we are taught God wants, and they're going to make the animals fast. In fact, there's this bizarre ending to the story, right? Did you catch that? The end of God's speech in source number 13. Shall I not have mercy on Nineveh, the great city, which includes more than 120,000 people who don't know right from left? And animals. Why are you throwing in the animals? Right? The opposite. It should be the animals first, and then the human beings. Says Rashi in source number 15, it doesn't mean the animals literally. It means human beings who are adults and yet whose minds are animalistic. They don't realize that I created them. God says, even if they don't act in the way that you think people should be acting, I value them. And that's a major, major lesson that we're supposed to pick up here. The boat, the sailors, the fish, the kikayon, the sun, the wind, the worm, they're all appointed by God for their roles in the book. In the Hebrew, it's vayiman. God appointed them. And you, Jonah, have a role as well. I appointed you for your role in the beginning of the story, and you, Jonah, are going to have to complete that task, and the people of Nineveh have a role to play as well. And to me, that's a critical message for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Learning to value ourselves and learning to value others, to forgive others, in fact, to have respect and love for others, to be able to come to that point is crucial. Yes, Susan, I see your hand, but I have one more surprise to spring here. And that is in number 16. And the surprise is that Jonah is not entirely wrong. Take a look at source number 16. And God spoke to Jonah a second time, it said in the book, after he got out of the fish. God spoke to him a second time. Says the Talmud, the Shekhinah spoke to him a second time within this book, but not a third time. God never speaks to Jonah again. He's retired from prophecy now. Because of this whole saga in the story, he's retired. However, he was right about Nineveh. Because in the end, I already explained from the book of Nahum, take a look at source number 17 from that book. God says he's going to punish Nahum. But here is the remarkable irony. The verse in which God indicts the city of Nineveh is, God is slow to anger and of great forbearance, but God does not cleanse of all punishment. He travels in whirlwind and storm, and clouds are the dust on his feet. But look at the beginning of that sentence. Remember Jonah's protest to God. Back in source number 3. I fled because I knew you are gracious and merciful, patient and very generous. Now God turns to the city of Nineveh and says, yes, it's true, I'm slow to anger. Yes, it's true, I am patient, but not forever. You can undermine your value. It's possible for a person to go too far. Jonah's not entirely wrong. This is still a dialectic. On the one hand, we value everything, and Jonah is incorrect for valuing only himself and that which he values, like that which takes care of him, like the Kikayon. He should value the city of Nineveh, but it's true that there are limits. Yeah?
What's the timeline between Jonah and
Nineveh? So you're talking about decades between the two. It's a couple of decades, I believe. If I remember correctly, I'm not 100% sure of that. I have to look at my notes on Nahum. Maybe I'll send that out in the follow-up email. It's a good question in terms of the chronology of Nahum, because I don't remember it for sure offhand. You can actually fix it because there are certain stories and events that are referenced in Nahum that allow us to do so. I just don't remember it. Susan. Yeah.
I think Jonah had shown a lot of mercy to the sailors. He had shown.
What's his mercy on the sailors?
He was willing to die for his dying son.
He was dying anyway.
But he said, "Throw me overboard and he was going to live." He didn't have to say that.
Okay.
And then his worry, like he kept saying that, he was worried about what the people of Nineveh, he knew that they were going to eventually attack, and then.
Right, and that's a school of thought, and I don't deny that that's a school of thought, that that's his goal, is he doesn't want the Jews to look bad, or he doesn't want them to attack. All of that is an attempt to read the story in a way that's consistent with Jonah being a Navi, being a prophet. How could he be a prophet and be so anti basic tenets of the way God has taught us he runs the world? So I don't discount what you're saying. However, the book lends itself very strongly to a different read. The very fact that he's so upset about the Kikayon and God rebukes him for it suggests that something else is going on here. I'm gonna pause you there because it's 11. Thank you so much. God willing, I will see you. I hope I will see you in November to talk about life after death for 6 weeks. So look for the follow-up email. Sorry. Samples? Life. Samples of life. Thank you very much. Happy and a healthy